today on Against the Grain, what's the relationship between literacy and power in the colonial context? I'm CS. The Australian scholar Laura Rademacher describes how English literacy became an arena of contestation between Christian colonizers and an Aboriginal community, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We can civilize them. We can teach them our religion. We can get them to learn our language. We can move them from ignorance to literacy. Thoughts like these, strategies such as these, have been pursued by countless colonizers and missionaries over many centuries, but their aims and ambitions have not always been realized. At many times and many places, indigenous people have refused to learn the language, or learned it only to wield it against mission authorities, against the colonizer. Laura Rademacher has spent time on an Australian island learning about an Aboriginal community targeted by a Christian mission. Rademacher is an historian based at the Center for Indigenous History at the Australian National University. Her article, Going Off Script, Aboriginal Rejection and Repurposing of English Literacies, appears in the volume Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire. The article is adapted from a chapter of Laura's book, Found in Translation, Many Meanings on a North Australian Mission. When Laura and I connected recently, I asked her what Western narratives of modernization, of what constitutes modernity, say about what happens when Indigenous societies make the transition from oral-based culture to literacy.
Sure. Well, we have this story that it's actually embedded in our very academic disciplines, that cultures progress from oral to literate, from savage to civilized, from traditional to sort of modern sophistication. When you look at the disciplines of history and archaeology, we divide our disciplines. We have prehistory before writing, and then history begins when cultures adopt writing. And I wanted to interrogate that assumption, to critique it. It's interesting, I guess, you see it particularly in the USA, this idea that Indigenous cultures, First Nation cultures, were especially vulnerable to colonization because they didn't have writing. But once writing arrives, cultures inevitably sort of give way, and Indigenous people are always eager to adopt writing because it's so sort of intrinsically superior to oral ways of communicating and oral traditions.
And is that the case, just speaking about Indigenous societies generally? Globally, is it the case that Indigenous people are eager to take up reading and writing when it's made available to them?
Sure. Well, it has been true in many places, but it's certainly not been a universal experience. Indigenous people have encountered writing in diverse ways and in different contexts, and so and have their own cultural and political and social priorities, and so have responded in really different ways and engaged with writing in really different ways. In the Pacific, quite famously, historians talk of the literate revolution that rolled through the Pacific when missionaries, who mostly were not actually Europeans, most missionaries in the Pacific were Pacific Islanders themselves, when they went to spread Christian texts, Pacific Islanders very quickly adopted writing in their own languages and were eager to learn to read, and there was a huge production of missionary texts. But in other contexts, that wasn't necessarily the case. It wasn't the case in Australia. First Nations peoples in Australia responded quite differently and diversely as well. And I'm particularly interested in the people of Groote Eylandt and the Aqua people there, who I argue rejected writing in English on the whole and were eager to maintain their oral ways of communicating and their oral cultures.
Yeah, so your piece looks at the history of Aboriginal people living in Groote Eylandt. Where is that?
Groote Eylandt, look, not many Australians know where Groote Eylandt is. Groote Eylandt, it's in the Gulf of Carpentaria in the north of Australia. So there's sort of a U shape at the top of Australia. It's in that body of water there.
Have indigenous people always lived on the island? And I guess it's also part of an archipelago, is that right?
Yes, so there's a cluster of islands that go out to Groote Eylandt. The largest one is Bickerton Island. Groote Eylandt hasn't been inhabited forever. Some of the clans arrived more recently, as early as the early 20th century. Others had been there for, archaeologists think, around 3,000 years. Groote Eylanders know it was a very long time, but unlike other Aboriginal people, Groote Eylanders will have stories of their migration to their country.
And how did Indigenous people on the island, how did they communicate, other than orally, before European and English writing came to the set of islands?
So Groote Eylanders, they have an ancient artistic tradition, and their art is quite distinct from other art from the mainland. They're famous for their bark paintings, which admittedly are more recent, which have a really striking black charcoal background, and then the images are superimposed on these black backgrounds, producing really striking images. And they record history and stories in these images. They also have been painting on rock for millennia, and there are some beautiful rock art, ancient rock art and more recent rock art, depicting the arrival of Macassans from Indonesia and the arrival of Europeans. Groote Eylanders, like many Aboriginal people, have used what they call message sticks to communicate. Now, these are, they function like a letter in a way. They're portable. It's a stick with carved and painted designs on it, which can pass on messages such as informing people when an important ceremony is going to be on, when a funeral is on, informing other groups that people are coming to visit and things like this. And these message sticks, although it's not, they don't use writing per se, they do use symbols and a combination of these secret symbols and mnemonic devices to communicate messages with other people groups.
So in other words, a fairly sophisticated and, as you were saying, artistic means of communication.
Yes, of course. And I should also have mentioned that songs have been really one of the primary ways of communicating history and story, especially with other groups. And for millennia, Groote Eylanders have met with people on the mainland for ceremony, and different groups will sing their different parts in the ceremony, the parts that tell stories about their country. And so these are the ways that stories about the landscape are passed down, but also the landscape itself in a way tells the story because of the way the stories are so connected to singing about the country.
Now, the indigenous people on Groote Eylandt, again, in off the coast of North Australia, the people you've investigated, you've researched, you've gone and talked to and written about, they first got exposed to English writing in 1943. What language did they speak, before they were exposed to English? And how did this particular group of people find their way to Groote Eylandt?
Yeah, it's important to remember that Anindilyakwa people, Groote Eylanders, have been multilingual for a very long time. It's not like English rolled along and for the first time they had to deal with another culture. Groote Eylanders traditionally will marry outside their clan, so they'll marry people who speak different languages. Groote Eylanders can speak Anindilyakwa, their own language, Nugumbuyu, one of the mainland languages, and various other languages from around North Australia. Many of them also could speak a Macassan Creole, which is a language from Indonesia, spoken on the fishing boats which would come down every year. But in 1943, a permanent mission settlement was established on Groote Eylandt. This actually wasn't their first encounter with the English language. There had been another mission established on Groote Eylandt in the 1920s, but this mission wasn't to Groote Eylanders themselves. It was actually a mission associated with what is known as the Stolen Generation in Australia. The Stolen Generation was when Aboriginal children with mixed racial descent, Aboriginal children with European heritage, were forcibly removed from their families. They were stolen by the police in many cases and taken to institutions. And this church missionary society that operated on Groote Eylandt had a mission for the so-called half-caste children on Groote Eylandt. So Groote Eylanders were able to observe the mission, and they interacted with the Europeans working there. They often traded with them. They supplied food to the mission and things like that. And they observed these children being subjected to European schooling. But it wasn't until the 1940s that a mission aimed at the Groote Eylanders themselves was established. And one of the core planks of this mission was I mean, they wanted to assimilate Groote Islanders into white Australia. They wanted to convert them to Christianity. And one of the core ways of doing this was to teach them to speak and to read English.
So they wanted to assimilate these Indigenous people into white Australia. And yet, you know, there must have been some racism felt by these missionaries, by these white missionaries. So I wonder to what extent some beliefs about the inferiority of Indigenous people, about the superiority of whites over people of color, might have affected the degree to which they really wanted these Indigenous people to assimilate into white Australian Christian ways, or more specifically, to become kind of the equivalent of white Australians in terms of status and rights.
Of course. I mean, the whole project is premised on a white supremacism, a sense of white racial superiority. You can see that in the way that they start with the what they call the half-caste children. Because of their white heritage, they were more able to assimilate, and then supposedly became more enlightened by believing that, in fact, you know, so-called what they used to call full-blooded Aboriginal people could also be made to assimilate. The missionaries thought this was a more enlightened position, but of course it's premised on the superiority of white culture, the belief that white Australia is more civilized and sophisticated, and that it was in Aboriginal people's best interest to become culturally indistinguishable from white Australia. And they talked quite openly. I mean, this was government policy, but talking quite openly in those terms, that Aboriginal people would be simply darker members of a white culture, and that they would have no cultural distinction at all.
That's the voice of Laura Rademacher. She is a postdoctoral research associate in the Center for Indigenous History at the Australian National University. We are talking about her article, Going Off Script, Aboriginal Rejection and Repurposing of English Literacies. It appears in the volume Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what did the missionaries do toward the end of assimilating these Indigenous people into Australian citizenship?
One of the primary ways that missionaries worked to assimilate was through the use of dormitories. So there was a dormitory set up almost immediately on Groote Island in the early 1940s. The dormitory had a number of goals. The missionaries said it was designed to prevent sexual violence against Aboriginal children. But of course, as we know, the children were exposed to sexual violence in these very dormitories at the hands of some of the missionaries. The dormitory was also designed to expose children constantly to the English language. English only was spoken in the dormitory. If the children wanted to speak their own language with each other, they had to do it in secret, you know, in their playtime or when they were out and about. But they were under constant surveillance from missionaries who enforced the English language. Now, in some cases, there were some Aboriginal parents who believed that learning to speak English would be valuable for their children. They saw that being able to speak English enabled you to, at times, outmaneuver the colonisers, to assert your own rights and interests. So there were some parents who cooperated with missionaries in allowing their children to go into these dormitories, but that was certainly not always the case, and there were many children who were forcibly removed without their parents' consent to live in these institutions.
So in terms of teaching these children English literacy in the school set up by the mission, we're talking about it was just incorporated in the curriculum. This is what you need to learn. This is what you need to read. And maybe what kinds of texts were children typically assigned to read in English?
Sure. Well, the Commonwealth government introduced a syllabus for Aboriginal children in the early 1950s, and the whole aim of this syllabus was to promote assimilation. So I went back and I read some of the little textbooks that were prepared, and you know, there are examples like Nari and Manella, these two fictional children, go to school. Nari and Manella get a job. Nari and Manella go to work. Nari and Manella read books. It was entirely drilling all the time this white Australian lifestyle that Aboriginal children were intended to conform to. The missions were funded by the Commonwealth government, and their funding was conditional on whether they used this curriculum. They were also under regular inspections. Inspectors would come and report on whether the missionary teachers ever used any Aboriginal languages, and there was the threat of funding being withdrawn if Aboriginal languages were found to be present in the classroom. And for that reason, children were also punished if they were speaking their languages at school. There was a very firm focus on English. And I even found one government document which conceded that Aboriginal languages would have been in the educational interest of the students. That is, that students would learn better if they were taught in their own languages, but in the interest of assimilation, and they flatly said that, in the interest of assimilation, English must be used.
Now, as part of your research, you have spoken with many people who lived at the mission, who experienced what the mission was trying to do. Again, we're talking about an island off the coast of North Australia that is part of Australia, where these Aboriginal people were encouraged, or in some cases coerced, to learn or to be instructed in English. And I'm wondering what they told you about the psychological effect of not being able to speak their language and having to speak and learn to read and write in English.
You can't understate how important the Anindilyakwa language is to Anindilyakwa people. The language is the way that knowledge is passed down through the generations, the way that country is understood, the way the landscape speaks, the way the songs are all in language. And so the possibility that this language would be eliminated was devastating. People told me about how when they were little children, they had to speak their language in secret with the other children, or they would have secret discussions with their parents and relatives around the mission in language. But they were always under a surveillance of missionaries, and in missionary presence they needed to speak English. Even those who had more positive memories of mission, and look, some of the memories of the mission time are diverse. Some people had better or worse experiences. Even those who converted to Christianity were still quite angry and resentful about the way their language was suppressed.
You note that missionary staff kept detailed written records. What kinds of things did they keep track of, and why did they keep these records?
I mean, this was great for me as an historian, that the mission archive was so comprehensive. The missionaries, they were obsessed with writing. I think writing was a way that they sort of felt like things were under control, the way that they impressed themselves, the way that they impressed their superiors. So there were records of all the children in the dormitory and in the school for every day, which they needed to supply to the government in order to continue receiving funding. But there were also every missionary from the mechanic, the superintendent, the home management instructress, whose job it was to teach Aboriginal women how to look after their houses in the ways that white women looked after their houses. They all had to write monthly reports and submit these to the Aborigines secretary of the Church Missionary Society in Sydney, and he would write back to them and appraise them or critique them for the way that they were working. So all of these records have been kept. The missionaries also, they often kept journals as part of their spiritual practice. They would read the Bible and they would reflect on biblical texts. The mission chaplain wrote sermons, and many of these have been kept. So there's a real thorough record, from the missionary perspective, of what was going on.
Can you talk more about what you were saying about writing on the part of the missionaries, by the missionaries, as a means of control, as a means of attempted control, a means of creating a kind of, I think in your piece you talk about creating kind of a rational order that made sense to the missionaries and that was in fact desired by the missionaries?
So by writing everything down in such detail, the missionaries were trying to create a rational, a modern society where people worked efficiently, where every hour was accounted for. All the Aboriginal workers, they were recorded, what they were doing and when. People's names were recorded in the ration book. Children's names were all included in the roll. There was expected to be a kind of order where everyone was accounted for. And that the missionaries could prove to the various government departments which oversaw their work and proved to their superiors down in Sydney that they were creating this civilised space. So writing was really bound up in this kind of civilising project that they were undertaking.
And did these records, written of course in English, the records kept by the missionaries, did they always deliver the kind of clarity that the missionaries wanted and create the kind of order that they desired?
No, it's ironic actually that the records were a cause of constant stress to the missionaries. It seems like they were never complete. There were always errors. The missionaries had problems with spelling Aboriginal names. The missionaries had diverse linguistic competence. Some of them really struggled with Aboriginal names, and so people's names are spelt in all kinds of different ways, and it was hard to know what was talking about who. But also Aboriginal family norms. So Anindaaka families don't, family relationships don't map on to the Western nuclear family model. It's quite normal for children to have many mothers, women in their extended kinship who, from a Western perspective, are not their biological mother, but from an Anindaaka perspective, are their mother and fulfill the role of mothers. Children have many mothers, many fathers, various aunties, cousin brothers, all these extended relations. And the missionaries just, they really struggled to work it out. They were trying to account for all these children, but they had trouble identifying. They recorded some people multiple times. They had missed others. They couldn't work out who was responsible for whom. Their supposedly rational, orderly system didn't map on to Anindaaka life or culture. It didn't create the rational order that they hoped for.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Laura Rademacher joins me. She is a postdoctoral research associate in the Center for Indigenous History at the Australian National University. We are talking about an article she contributed to the volume Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire. And that article is a condensed version of a chapter in Laura's book called Found in Translation, Many Meanings on a North Australian Mission. Her article and that chapter examine how Aboriginal people on a North Australian island responded to efforts by Christian missionaries to get them to learn and read and write English, and what this says about the relationship between language, literacy, identity, power, quote, civilization, religion, and colonialism. Talk more about the importance of writing to the missionary sense of their religion, their Protestant religion, and of their civilizational status.
For the missionaries, their religion was so bound up in literacy, they had trouble conceiving of how one could be a Christian apart from reading and writing. So as I mentioned, they had their quiet times. This was, you know, personal reflection and Bible reading each day, not because they wanted to read the Bible to get more information, but because it was a ritual practice for them. Reading was part of their spirituality. They talk about lay readers. The preaching on a Sunday is done by readers. Their Sunday services were controlled by the prayer book, with readings from the prayer book, readings from the Bible. The missionaries talked about not being able to relate to Indigenous people who couldn't read because reading was so much a part of their spiritual practice. And so also as Protestants, you know, personal reflection, personal Bible reading and personal interpretation of the Bible and practices like Bible studies where they discuss the meaning of biblical texts and ask questions of each other, all of this was integral to their religion, which is perhaps all the more interesting why they didn't translate the Bible and why they didn't pay attention to Aboriginal languages. You would expect as Protestants that would have been the beginning of their mission, the translated Bible that was going to speak to Aboriginal people. But interestingly, they were so bound up in this ideology of assimilation of Aboriginal people, in a way their commitment to whiteness and their commitment to assimilation triumphed over their evangelical commitment to Bible translation. But it remained a literate religion, but they expected Aboriginal people to become Christians in English.
And for them, as you write, the missionaries, English literacy was also a symbol and a precondition of citizenship. You've already referred to this. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, certainly. The missionaries talked about eventually Aboriginal people would be granted citizenship rights and they would be able to vote in elections and they would be able to participate in white Australia. But all of that hinged on whether or not Aboriginal people could gain the kind of literacy that missionaries themselves had. It was going to be a conditional citizenship, and they saw that literacy was central to all of that.
And we've talked a lot about the efforts missionaries made to get children to learn to read and write in English. What efforts did the missionaries make to reach out to adult Aboriginal people on this North Australian island and to get them to engage with English and to write it?
So the mission, it really was focused on children. They were most intensely pressured to assimilate. But Aboriginal people, or Aboriginal adults, also worked on the mission for rations and later for pay. And these people were encouraged to, for example, to record their work in the pay book, to write their names, to sign their names, and to start being sort of enculturated into this mission literacy, into this culture that the missionaries participated in. They were also conditionally rewarded for performing kinds of literacy, especially Christian kinds of literacy. So there's examples of Aboriginal people. One man in particular wrote a letter describing his conversion experience and wanting to read the Bible. And this letter was published in the mission newsletter. And he was richly praised for this kind of writing and for this kind of desire to read, and was rewarded with leadership and authority in the church.
Yeah, and in fact, some adults who were part of this Aboriginal community must have seen a certain benefits to learning to read and write in English.
Definitely, there were benefits to learning to read and write, and especially as people were thinking about, well, how could they assert their interests through things like petitions and reading and writing and following the news and things like that. Remember, there's no TV back in the day. Reading and writing was a potential route to assert Aboriginal interests. And there's an example of the Anindaaka people actually gathered together and arranged some petitions that they sent down to the Secretary for Aborigines in Sydney, demanding that the superintendent be replaced. In a way, they were kind of enacting this literate citizenship that the missionaries had wanted. They were using writing to assert their interests and express a kind of self-determination for their community. They were participating like democratic citizens should. But interestingly, well, actually not interestingly, surprisingly, well, not unsurprisingly, I should say, this was not received well by the Mission Society. When Aboriginal people did write, their writing was often rejected and questioned. In this case, it was assumed that their petition was inauthentic, that a missionary had put them up to it, and they couldn't possibly have been demanding their rights like this. So even though Aboriginal people saw writing could produce some avenues for freedom and for asserting their interests, when Aboriginal people pursued this, these were quickly squashed by missionaries.
Ah, right. This is an example, and there are a number of others in your article, about the Aboriginal people, the Indigenous people, going off script, right?
What happened was, when people did embrace reading and writing, they used it in ways that the missionaries didn't anticipate and that missionaries often frowned upon. They didn't use the Christian literacy, this sort of literate citizenship, in the way that missionaries hoped.
And what do you find significant about that? Is it that when we talk about people who are exploited or oppressed, that often the focus is on their status as victims? And in this case, this pushes back against that idea that, you know, these people had agency and they would act independently of the desires of, in this case, the missionaries, even if they, you know, did adopt some form of literacy?
Yes, I guess I'm pushing back. I don't want to deny that these people had been victims of huge injustice at colonization, but also that in this, they have had agency and have asserted themselves and have seized these technologies and these new forms of knowledges that the missionaries brought, and have used them, turned them against the missionaries and turned them against the colonial authorities. So there's agency even in these situations of great inequality and injustice.
I read one of the letters, it's in your piece, written to, I guess, the central authority, urging that the new superintendent, Mr. Taylor, be removed from his post, as you alluded to earlier. The spelling and grammar are irregular, to say the least, and, you know, it makes sense. These people are learning a new language. But couldn't this be pointed to by the higher-ups to say that the letter writers weren't thinking clearly or weren't qualified to make judgments about the performance of this superintendent they didn't like?
Sure, and that's exactly what happened. It was argued that Anadyaka people didn't have the capacity to write petitions asserting their interest. They didn't point to the irregular spelling and grammar in the letter. It was more a general point about, Anadyaka political capacity. But yes, it was deemed that these letters that were demanding a change in superintendent were generated by a disgruntled missionary, that they weren't authentic to Anadyaka people.
Did this strategy of silencing or trying to silence Indigenous claims by questioning their authenticity, was that a common strategy? And I'm not just thinking of authorities in Australia, but just more generally?
Yes, it has been a common strategy to suggest that Indigenous people have been puppets that mimic non-Indigenous people in their world, and that they're essentially beholden to non-Indigenous interests. When Indigenous people assert themselves, it's very quickly undercut as not authentically Indigenous. Indigenous people are today as well constantly asked to prove their authenticity, that they really are acting as Indigenous people. And I think this is a starker example where the authorities frankly said, oh, this is not authored by Indigenous people, but there are many other more subtle ways that Indigenous authority is undercut through this question of authenticity.
Laura Rademacher is her name, Rademaker. She's a scholar based at the Center for Indigenous History at the Australian National University. She's author of Found in Translation, Many Meanings on a North Australian Mission. And one of the chapters of that book has been adapted, turned into an article called Going Off Script, Aboriginal Rejection and Repurposing of English Literacies. You can find it in the new volume, Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. On againstthegrain.org, we've put a link to Laura and her work and her book and to the book Indigenous Textual Cultures. Sweetheart letters. You point to the practice of writing sweetheart letters by the Aboriginal folks and how the missionaries responded to it. What happened?
Yes, so part of the reason for the establishment of the dormitory was the missionaries were concerned that girls were getting married too young. In Anadyaka kinship system, girls are promised in marriage to older men and would often marry quite young. Girls would often have their boyfriends, their promised husbands in the bush, and these men would be obliged to give gifts to them and give gifts to the girls' kin. And so it's really important for them to maintain these relationships despite the presence of the dormitory. And these girls are learning to read and write, and they put their newfound literacy to work in the kinship system to secure their relationships with their promised husbands, and also to make claims on their promised husbands to continue giving gifts to them and their relatives. So the girls start writing these love letters to men associated with the mission, and the men write letters back. And look, you would think that the missionaries should praise this. Look, the girls are becoming literate, they're writing letters, they're behaving in a way like white Australians by their letter writing. But of course the missionaries didn't at all endorse this. They were greatly alarmed that Anadyaka girls would start using writing to uphold part of their culture that the missionaries were trying to stamp out. They were alarmed. They started instituting punishments for anyone found writing a letter to a dormitory girl, or any dormitory girl found writing a letter. Girls were given the strap, and I'm sure there were many other corporal punishments for letter writers. There was one example of a girl who received a letter from a man outside the dormitory, and she apparently wasn't interested in this man's advances, and actually handed over his letter to missionaries, and he was exiled from the island. He was kicked out of his own country, made to live in the mainland. Eventually he was jailed in Darwin for unrelated reasons, but for Groot Islanders this was evidence that firstly the missionaries had great power, but also that letter writing was such a terrible offence to the missionaries that you could be jailed in Darwin for writing letters. But this didn't stop the letters being written. The girls continued to write their sweetheart letters. The men who were promised to the girls continued to write letters back. The missionaries had great difficulty controlling any of this. The writing was out of their control.
Being punished for writing sweetheart letters, having the authorship of their complaints to mission authorities, be questioned. I mean, this must have made a lot of these letter writers rethink the whole literacy initiative pursued by the missionaries.
Sure. I mean, it's only logical. These missionaries come in and they were obsessed with reading and writing and getting Aboriginal people to read and write. And then when they do, their writing is dismissed. They are punished for writing. They're deemed to be writing in the wrong way. They're not performing the civilized Christian citizenship that the missionaries anticipated. And their writing is suppressed. And my understanding is that this caused many Anangadhyaka people to turn their backs on written literacy altogether. It wasn't offering the benefits that missionaries promised. In fact, they were being punished for their writing. And I think many people chose not to engage with the missionaries from this point, not to pursue learning to read and write, and to continue to practice a solely oral culture.
Yeah, and you write that by refusing to learn how to read, for example, you could kind of make a statement about the value to you of church teachings, of mission rules, of all kinds of things that you think the missionary is trying to get you to adhere to.
Exactly. I mean, if you can't read, you can't participate, you're not participating in the services on Sunday, which require reading from hymn books and prayer books. If you can't read, you can't be expected to follow missionary rules, which are posted on the notice boards. You know, they put the names of people with the cleanest and dirtiest houses on the notice board and put rules and shamed people up through these written announcements. But if you can't read, you're untouched by that. The missionaries, they can't enforce their regulations on you. If you can't read, you couldn't be expected to follow the timetables necessarily or to know what work expectations were required of you. It's a way of evading the missionaries, of escaping out from underneath them, and I guess containing their influence.
By the late 1960s, the mission authorities, again, on this North Australian island where Aboriginal people were taught to read and write English, and many of the adults in this Aboriginal population were encouraged to learn how to read and write. Your research focuses a lot on how these people responded to efforts by Christian missionaries to get them to learn English. So the mission authorities in the late 60s, as you alluded to much earlier, became committed to bilingual education in both English and in the language. And I'm sorry, yeah, I can't pronounce the language. How did this go? How did this bilingual initiative go?
So the missionaries, they saw that assimilation simply wasn't working, and they became convinced that bilingual education was the way to reach Aboriginal people, the way to Christianise them, but also would be more effective for their education. But by this stage on Groote Island, in a way it was too late. Anangadhyaka people were rejecting written literacies of all forms. I spoke to one older man who's now passed away. I asked him if he wanted to learn to read in his language, and he said, no, I didn't want to learn Anangadhyaka because I could speak Anangadhyaka. He was asserting that his language was going to remain a spoken language. And I guess by resisting the writing down of his language, he was also resisting missionary interference in his language. The missionaries couldn't know his language in the way that he did. They couldn't gain control of it. They couldn't contain it in a dictionary and a grammar. They couldn't claim to have that knowledge over Aboriginal people and cultures. It was a way of continuing to evade them and to evade their claim to be authorities in his culture and on his country. So, there were some individuals who were enthusiastic about the bilingual program, but the missionaries always struggled to find volunteers who were going to teach their language, who were going to work closely with the linguists, and who were going to work in the school. There wasn't great enthusiasm for it. It was left to a few isolated individuals, and the missionaries faced criticism right through the 70s that there wasn't a single Aboriginal person on Groote Island who could read Anangadhyaka fluently, despite by this stage a decade of missionary insistence that now they were going to be bilingual and they were going to use language in the school. Anangadhyaka people continued to evade missionaries by a kind of passive resistance.
This must have confused missionaries, because in seeing a lot of people resisting English literacy, many of them probably thought, well, if we teach them how to read and write in their own language, at least they'll accept that.
Yes, I mean, in a way, you feel sorry for the missionaries. They're sort of starting to make these concessions to culture, but they're not thinking about the way that over decades, their authority and their control over Indigenous lives has shaped the way that Aboriginal people are engaging with writing, the way they see the whole purpose of writing. Writing was an instrument of assimilation and colonisation. And it seems that in this case, they sort of said, well, thank you very much, but no thanks. We are going to remain the authorities in our language, and our language is an oral language.
Why did an Indigenous resident on the island we've been talking about, Groote Island, ask a white anthropologist named David Turner to, quote, write their Bible, write the Bible of this Indigenous community?
So David Turner came in the late 60s, and interesting, the missionaries tried to stop him. They really didn't want an alternative non-Indigenous perspective on the island. But he came to do his research on Groote Island in the late 60s, and Nadjawara Amagula, who, interesting, was a church leader, so he had embraced a lot of the missionary culture, although, again, not always in the ways that missionaries hoped. He asked them to write their Bible, to record their culture in a book in a way that could be an authority in later discussions around land rights and whose territory was where. To me, this shows it's interesting because Nadjawara didn't want to read this Bible to gain more information, but there's a sense of recognition of the authority that having something in a book brings. The physical presence of a book, it signals, or it can be used to signal a legitimacy, an authority. And so by having Anindilyakwa knowledge in a book, it was a kind of validation of Anindilyakwa knowledge. But also, this isn't to say that Anindilyakwa ways of resolving disputes were completely overturned. Turner argued, he said that if what he'd written didn't suit Nadjawara's interests, the book would simply be dismissed and they would say, oh, what could a white man know about us? We could dismiss this book if it's not what we want. The book's authority came from the old people that gave Turner the knowledge, rather than from the script itself. So in a way, Nadjawara was having it both ways. He was recognising that there's a certain legitimacy that can be asserted through having things in books, but ultimately his cultural knowledge was bound up in the old people and their knowledge of country.
I'm joined by Laura Rademacher, postdoctoral research associate at the Australian National University, and specifically the Center for Indigenous History there. We've been talking about an article she contributed to the volume Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire. And that article derives from her book called Found in Translation, Many Meanings on a North Australian Mission. And in fact, that is just one chapter of your book, Found in Translation. What else does your book address?
I guess I'm really interested in the way that differences in language and culture and the necessity of translation shaped the encounter between Indigenous people and missionaries, and the ways that Indigenous people exploited this difference, exploited missionary ignorance and white people's ignorance of language to find ways to manoeuvre in a really unequal situation of power, in a really unequal context. So this example, the ways that Indigenous people chose not to learn to read and write, but other times the ways that Aboriginal people translated Christianity in ways that upheld their relationships to country, the ways that upheld their knowledge. I'm interested in understanding that Aboriginal people haven't only been victims, although there has been great injustice, in finding, seeing the ways that they made the most of a bad situation, really, and exploited the situation to pursue their interests.
What kinds of translation do you address in this book, Found in Translation? I understand at least a part of it was that this Church Missionary Society, which I guess was kind of the organization that oversaw the foundation of the mission in 1943 that we've been talking about, translated biblical texts into the native tongue. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the mission, I mean, eventually, this wasn't until the late 60s because of the overwhelming focus on English, but they eventually worked on translating portions of scripture and translating the prayer book and things like that into Anindilyakwa. But what was really interesting, and David Turner reported on this, that Anindilyakwa people took parts of the Christian story and integrated it into their own songlines, their own spiritual practices, completely without the knowledge of the missionaries. This was completely apart from missionaries. It wasn't a missionary thing. In fact, the missionaries thought that they had really failed to convert anyone and that there hadn't been much interest in Christianity. What they were witnessing was the Aboriginal people's rejection of their Christianity and their kinds of spiritual practice, but Aboriginal people were embedding Christian meanings in the landscape and singing about them in their own funeral songs and in their own ceremonial practices in ways that the missionaries just had no idea about.
We've been talking a lot about the writing, trying to get people to write English. Your book focuses also on trying to get people to speak English. What were the responses of this Aboriginal community to those efforts?
So in the same way that the missionaries were obsessed with getting people to learn to read English, getting people to speak English in a correct and proper way that they deemed to be proper was part of the civilizing mission. It was a way that Aboriginal people were meant to embody a kind of a civilized citizenry. But Aboriginal people were not as interested in learning to speak English as missionaries hoped, and actually used the difference in language to evade missionaries. It was very easy to not learn to speak English, but it was also easy to feign misunderstanding, to not understand missionaries' instructions, to make it seem as if what missionaries were saying were falling on deaf ears. And missionaries really had no way of controlling this. When missionaries wanted to learn to speak Aboriginal languages to get themselves understood, often Anadyaka people would give them, you know, would do the old trick of giving them a swear word or something rude, or, you know, telling them genitalia meant hello or something like that. And missionaries were often found to be making a fool of themselves when they tried to speak language. Then at the same time, when they tried to give people instructions about how work should be done or about the Christian message, very often Aboriginal people apparently seemed not to understand. So there's a kind of passive resistance and an active resistance through language because of the missionaries' linguistic incompetence that Aboriginal people exploited to limit the missionary imposition in their lives.
Your book goes into the broader context of kind of Australian colonization policy. Can you talk about the context? And maybe we could talk about the three decades, the 40s, 50s, and 60s. That's the kind of the period where you focus your essay in the book, Indigenous Textual Cultures. What was going on in terms of official policy in relation to Aboriginal people?
So there was quite a crisis in Aboriginal affairs in the 1930s. There was a lot of humanitarian activism down south, a lot of movement from the churches and various academics and communists lobbying the government, saying that the living conditions of Aboriginal people wasn't acceptable. And there was a debate about what the future of Aboriginal people was going to be. Until this time, white Australia had assumed that Aboriginal people were simply going to die out, that they would become extinct, and so there was no need for a long-term policy approach to Aboriginal people. But from the 30s, it became apparent that actually Aboriginal people weren't going anywhere. And the debate was whether to segregate Indigenous people on reserves away from white Australia, or whether to assimilate Aboriginal people into white Australia. And I guess the real deciding factor was the Second World War. The presence of military troops up in the Northern Territory in these formerly remote parts of Australia, and American troops too, it became apparent that Aboriginal people couldn't be simply kept apart, that they were a presence in Australia, but also that they were very capable. Aboriginal people were integral to the war effort in North Australia. And so this tipped the balance in terms turned to an assimilation type policy, where the goal was for Aboriginal people to acquire supposedly the skills and the capacities to eventually become integrated into white Australia. And this was spoken of as if it was an anti-racist policy, as if all the alternatives were the racist option, and this was the one which believed in Aboriginal capacity. But of course, it's all premised on Aboriginal people conforming to white Australian culture and on the superiority of white Australian culture and the assumption that Aboriginal culture was somehow backwards, underdeveloped, unsophisticated. And Aboriginal people faced severe restrictions on their daily lives under assimilation policy. They had no freedom of movement. They couldn't marry without permission. They couldn't leave these mission areas. They couldn't go and choose where they wanted to be educated or anything like that. Aboriginal people were confined to reserves and missions largely and couldn't move about without the permission of the various government bureaucrats. And so this policy, which was supposedly about, you know, citizenship and integration and freedom, actually had a similar result in terms of isolating Indigenous people and restricting their freedoms. It was a highly paternalistic policy, even though it claimed to be the enlightened policy that was going to bring citizenship rights. It actually denied Aboriginal people citizenship rights and freedoms.
So Laura, how did you get involved in this kind of research anyway? What attracted you to this particular community in this part of Australia and these sets of issues?
Sure. Well, look, I should have said this up front. I'm not Indigenous myself. I would hope to be an ally to Indigenous people, but ultimately that's something for them to judge. I got interested in mission history around 2008. So Kevin Rudd, then Prime Minister of Australia, issued an apology to the Stolen Generation. These are the children who were forcibly removed from their families and made to live in institutions or adopted out to white families. Kevin Rudd gave this apology, and I learned that this mission organisation, the Church Missionary Society, that my family had always supported, was implicated in this Stolen Generation. The Church Missionary Society had taken in these children who had been removed from their families. So I learned that this is a past that my family, people just like me, had been intimately involved in, that the nice white women were not always the goodies of the story, and that this is something with which I personally needed to come to terms intellectually, but also emotionally and spiritually. So it set me on this path that I started researching mission history. I wanted to learn more about North Australia because this is where this organisation had worked. And I was particularly interested in Groote Eylandt because of this question around language. I knew that there had been people working to translate the Bible there, and I knew that there had been a bilingual program there that had fallen apart. And so I wanted to understand how language shaped that colonizing encounter.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. Laura Rademacher, postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Indigenous History at the Australian National University, author of Found in Translation, Many Meanings at a North Australian Mission, and a chapter of that book has been adapted for the new volume and incorporated into the new volume, Indigenous Textual Cultures, Reading and Writing in the Age of Global Empire, published by Duke University Press. Thanks so much, Laura, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.